I thought I'd talk about this empty space ensemble project a little bit because it's kind of unique. It's not the usual structure that I've been used to running around doing original theater. And it's the kind of thing I think has got a lot of valuable aspects to it. I don't know if anybody will ever get a chance to work this way again, but I thought I'd talk about how it all came about, talk about the two projects we're doing, because we approached each of them pretty differently. And then I thought I might read a little from Eric's play, because it's pretty hallucinatory prose. Give you a little preview. It's brand new. It's going to be massively rewritten between now and the time we opened it. It's pretty cool. I've been in Seattle since 77. I worked at Intimon. I did about six seasons there. I think that came out to be about 24 shows I did at Intimon. And then lately I've worked a lot at ACT. Done about 12 or 15 shows there. And I've traveled since 82. Last 10 years, I've spent a lot of time in Milwaukee. If you add up all the time over the last 10 years I've been in Milwaukee, it comes out to a little over 3 years. So a chunk of time there, about 20 shows there. And this ensemble project started, I was sitting in Milwaukee in the hotel there, the Plaza Hotel. I'd been there since August, and it was December. In December in Milwaukee can get really ugly. Very dark, very cold, and very lonesome and homesick. The phone rang. Kurt Beatty says, how'd you like to do a 6-month project with a bunch of people? You guys can do anything you want for 6 months. We can't pay you very much, but we'll pay you as much as we can, and you guys have total artistic control. So that sounded like it might be a pretty good thing to do. He listed the people he was talking to. He was talking to guys like Bob. At this point, it was all men, by the way, which is possibly significant. We can get into that later. He was talking about Bob Wright, David Bichette, Jeff Stitzer himself, Larry Ballard, and Rex McDowell. Now, these are all a group that I would want as my favorite actors, guys I've done a lot of work with. Ballard and I have done 35 shows together in like 5 different states over the last 15 years. We just keep showing up together. And you know how that is, I'm sure. The students you work with on projects, a lot you get to know, and you can just dispense with a lot of the preliminary bullshit that you have to do when you walk in fresh to a new company. So the idea of working with these people sounded great. So I said, yeah. So I stuck it out in Milwaukee another 8 weeks. I came back here and we started having meetings. Then I went to Berkeley for March, April, May, and June. When I got back in June, we started in earnest. And what Kurt wanted to do, I made some notes. What Kurt wanted to do basically was empower actors in the standard Lord configuration. Directors only. People who run theaters are called artistic directors. There aren't any artistic actors out there. Hardly any companies are, well, you know, there are, but very few companies are run by actors. They're either run by playwrights or directors, in my experience. Which isn't a bad thing. But what it means is usually you get jobbed in, you know, if you're an actor. Phone rings and say, are you available March 15th, opens April 12th, closes, you know, May something. And you look at your calendar and say, yeah, I am, or no, I'm not. And that's about the last artistic choice you have. You show up and you do the play. Now, I mean, theater is a collaborative art, and of course you have artistic choices. But you don't have much artistic power. So what Kurt wanted to do was put the actors in charge. And he was able to do that pretty much because the space was in so much trouble. His back was basically against the artistic wall, and he might as well do this. If it failed, well, you know, it was always possible that the theater was going to go under anyway. So he took a big artistic risk. We started by reading a lot of plays. We'd get together all through the summer on Mondays and start reading stuff. Everybody would bring in stuff they wanted to do. And we started by considering mostly stuff like the Oresteia and Hamlet and Peer Gynt and Jacobean Tragedy. We wanted to do something, in other words, huge, risky, athletic, and virtuosic, if that's a word. We wanted to do stuff we didn't get a chance to do elsewhere, since we had this opportunity. So we did read a ton of this stuff, and as the summer sort of got into the fall, we knew we were going to go to work January 1, basically. As the summer kind of got into fall, Eric Overmeyer's project showed up. Kurt said, Eric Overmeyer would like to write a play for you guys. Do you have any interest in that? And we had the yes or no, and we said, yeah, absolutely, Eric Overmeyer sounds good. He wrote On the Verge, he wrote In Perpetuity Throughout the Universe. Very well-known playwright. His day job is he writes for Fox TV. So that became one of the two projects we were going to do. And it was supposed to be the first one. But then he said, I can't finish this play. I need another about 2 months. So we decided we would make up the first play. We'd be responsible for the first play. So after reading The Revenger's Tragedy and The White Devil and She's Pity, She's Poor and stuff, we started, the concept sort of grew that maybe we should do an evening of pieces. And we didn't want it to be a one-act festival. And we didn't want it to be a review. We thought we'd like to be able to do something like do a scene from the Jacobean Tragedy, people plotting poisoned skulls, daggers, dangerous people, and then walk through a door into a fait de farce. We wanted to do these sort of compelling juxtapositions. Greg Boyd, the director friend of mine, would say. So we worked with this concept well. We had all these plays and all these pieces, and we were making this sort of melange of it. Well, these are my notes from yesterday's run through. Not going to do us a lot of it, but. I think the reason we finally settled on a comedy structure was, well, one day we were all having dinner in Vince's, not drinks, but dinner. And we had been working with this idea of flipping from one thing to another, and we said, okay, it's a house with a lot of doors. That's it. So maybe it's a house with a lot of doors, and every time you walk into one, something else happens to you. Okay? Well, maybe there should be one innocent who wanders through this thing, and it all happens to him or her. Okay? Maybe it should be two innocents. Well, that's too much like Rocky Horror. Okay, so. All right, sorry, don't have this. So we had this idea, and then somebody said, well, it's Dr. Terror's House of Theater. So we had this title when we went into rehearsal. And that's all we had. We had a title. A pile of scripts. And for a while, it was going to be a sort of a combination of Three Sisters and Hamlet. Irina and Ophelia were going to be sort of this bipolar unity. Anyway, we started working on all this stuff, and eventually got down to, well, we can't do whole scenes. Let's just do fragments, absolute fragments. Two lines from this, four lines from that, a crossover with no lines. And we could do this. We can do this. We can make an interesting structure. So for 2 weeks, we sat around the table in the office, two solid weeks out of an 8-week rehearsal period, figuring out who Dr. Terror was and why he had a house of theater and what it was. We went through some very entertaining scenarios. By the way, how many people have seen that, the show? Okay, that's fine. What we wound up with was not anything like this. What we wound up with was a play called The Blood Orgy of the Bermuda Triangle, Zombie Assassins. around which we do a telethon. Well, for a while we're going to be a theater troupe in Eastern Europe. We're going to be an American theater troupe, the U.S. Information Agency, doing a show off the back of a truck in Bulgaria, explaining to the natives how the market economy works. It's going to open with a cheese ball production number explaining the free market system. And we wound up opening with a cheese ball production number, so that concept stuck. And then we were going to, the idea was the president of this country was a sort of a Václav Havel character, a great theater genius who during like the Prague spring of 68 came to the United States, directed a landmark production sort of a la the Living Theater at Yale. Well, J.D. Salinger, you know, made a huge cultural splash and then disappeared. Went back to his homeland where he was imprisoned when the clampdown came. He's been in prison for 20 years, he just got out of prison, and he kidnaps this troupe of American actors because he's going to finally create the production of Hamlet that he worked on for 20 years in his prison cell, where he rehearsed with rats. You're going to have a little thing with rats. And then for a while we were going to be a British left-wing theater troupe, sort of a la Peter Brook's company, who were on their way to a great international theater festival in someplace like Bulgaria or Iran. The Shah had Peter Brook's company once at a huge birthday party. So we figured we were these left-wing rock and roll street guys, left-wing Brits on this cruise ship. And then we all get either killed or kidnapped, and the cheese ball lounge entertainers on the cruise ship have to pretend to be the left-wing theater troupe. We went through all these permutations. Okay, so then Jeff Stitzer, at the end of the 2 weeks of hell, brought in a play called Bermuda Triangle Zombie Assassins, which had been written by Eddie Levi Lee and Larry Larson, two guys who ran a company in Atlanta called the Southern Theater Conspiracy, where they did real plays, real artistic plays. But once a year, they put together these sort of carnival, bacchanal, Fat Tuesday sort of celebrations. There were three of them. They were all called Blood Orgy of something. And they were all written in about a week apiece, slapped together. And their main characteristics are dick jokes, blood, drag acts, bad jokes. He said, ah, perfect, exactly what we need. So we started working on Blood Orgy, and Jeff Stitzer actually, it needed to be massively rewritten, and fortunately Eddie Lee has moved to Seattle. He's now going to play this running down Annex, he's going to play this called Hunchback in the Game. He tends to have hunchbacks in all these plays. So Jeff Stitzer, in collaboration or with permission from Eddie, basically skinned it, bummed it, gutted it, totally reordered it, cut lots of characters, added a few characters. And that became sort of the core of the evening. And then the other part of the evening is this telethon. We invented all of this, so we had a big bulletin board and a lot of 3x5 cards, and every time we had an idea for some dumb act, we'd stick it up on this board. And pretty soon we had a board that was just full of 3x5 cards that said things like Peter's Song, Dog Act, Hamster Hamlet. And finally, after 6 weeks, we sort of winnowed it down into a two-hour show. We started previews. From the beginning of previews to the end of previews, we cut 40 minutes out of the show. A lot of the stuff that went, I thought was tremendously funny, but the whole thing was just too long, so certain artistic considerations came in. In fact, certain bourgeois theater considerations came in, something that was supposed to be attacking. But at a certain point, we all sort of panicked and said, we gotta make this work. It has to work. That's a dead spot. Yeah, but it's, you know, we think it's funny. Yeah, but they don't. So a lot of stuff went over my screening objections. Over everyone's screening objections, but they had to go. The psalms went, skits went, stuff. But what we wound up with was this sort of bacchanalian thing, I hope. We wanted to do dumb theater. Oh, shit. Way too long. we wanted to do dumb theater. Okay, why? I think it's important. Because I'm the oldest guy in this group. I'm 46. Most of the other people in it are about 40. They've all gone through the regional theater mill. They've all been a little misused. It tends to happen. You get misused. You plug in, you do your job. We wanted to do something that we thought was fun. We wanted to exploit our own senses of humor, like maybe for the last time. Because we're all getting a little old to do this. We tend to break bones. I broke my wrist. Bob Wright's knee blew up a few years ago. He can't do the things he used to do. And it gets to be, you wonder if you have peaked physically and emotionally and everything else, because I've been acting for a long time. I mean, I got out of college in 69. I got out of graduate school in 72. So I got my MFA in 72, so it's now 92. So I've been doing it for 20 years. If I do it for 20 more years, I'll be 66. So you gotta figure I'm about at least midpoint or halfway past it, you know? So we wanted to do something anarchic and chaotic before it was too late. And I think we did that. I'm very proud of what we did and what we're still doing. By the way, it still runs Friday and Saturday. Two more chances. I'm pretty proud of it. I think it's pretty dumb. I think we achieved the level of stupidity. I'm all pretty proud of it. It has a little historical background. You know, the empty space under Bird's direction created this thing called a park show, which all through the 70s and into the 80s were these outdoor touring shows, mostly all comedies, all with music. And all with a very specific sort of comic sensibility. Really smart dumbness. Really clever dumbness. And I think we've a little bit resurrected it. Not because it was so valuable a form to resurrect, although I think it should live. It's just we wanted to do it one more time before we all die. So that's what we got. Before I go on and talk about Dark Rapture, any questions about this idea?
Yeah. Did you use this as a lot of questions, but I'll try and pull it down to one. Do you know that this will maybe spur on other smaller regional theaters to try this work, try and work collaborative work?
I think it would be a good idea. I don't think it will have that effect, really. Nobody knows about it. A lot of theaters have resident companies. There's a sort of a continuum between being strictly a jobber, then being a member of a resident company, then being a member of an ensemble. And there are some distinct differences. If you're a member of a resident company, you have a little more power, you have a little more say, because they know you're going to be around. They want to keep you around. And you have a little mutual loyalty. So you might actually affect the choice of some projects. They might actually listen to you when you say, this costume won't work, or you know, do I have to come in from over there? Would it be better if I came in from over there? Finally, you get a little power. But to actually create an ensemble that's responsible for creating its own material all the time, I don't know if anybody's really going to go for that. Mm-hmm. I doubt it.
But if you did, like, maybe once a year, you know, outside of their normal season, like maybe like the rep stage two, maybe once a season, stage two would do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't expect them to have a full season of completely ensemble work.
They do create some stuff over there. They entered Inspecting Carol this year.
Yeah.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in the
Milwaukee
they have the funds to do. Is it a three-stage is with no script and a general idea of a theme, and then the actors got to screw around until they made up little scenes and then they put it all together.
Right.
So, but it's, that's like with a place with more money and
yeah, these things are time intensive and money intensive. If you're going to put a bunch of actors in a room together with somebody like Daniel Stein or King Chong, you have to be able to pay those actors for 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks, and you have to free them up from other projects that your theater's running, if you're running 3 stages. So I don't know, they have a lot of people on the payroll there. The money constraints are really tough.
Did you have any sort of director at all to shape things, or was it completely?
No sort of director at all. No, we all mutually directed it.
And how did that work? Was that sheer help? Yeah. How did you make those cuts then?
It was always a meeting of minds. We never had a single fight over anything. We had differences of opinion, but no one ever got emotional about a single cut. I say screamed, but that's not really true. If you weren't on stage, you were watching what was going on stage and basically directing it, or you were sitting over at the computer, which is in the back of the room, writing the next piece. You were there for 8 hours every day. And it's not like if you're in a play, you're only called for scenes 1, 3, and 5. You have to be there for 2, 4, and 6. No, 24 hours a day, basically. Yeah, once we got into tech, Kurt sort of took over as the eye in the house. So we could say, no, the sound cue has to come just before the light came on. Then we needed to have that.
So he shaped
it a little bit. But mostly it was all communal.
And would you have hoped for more time?
No, I think 8 weeks for this was just about right.
Would you have been getting more time? Would you be tired?
No, I think we probably, it would have just kept changing. The pace of change was almost constant. It would have just kept evolving. Probably would have been better. But what we went into text with, what we started previous with, I thought was really workable. You know, good raw material. So I wouldn't have asked for more time. No, not for this.
What has been your audience reaction? Are you aware of, do you know that? Heard of.
Yeah, well, 3 things. I'm going to tell someone to talk about that. The audiences, the critics, and women in general, specifically. The audiences have been kind of small, but the thing I'm most proud of in this project is even with Place Seats 150, we've had an awful lot of houses in the 40 to 60 range, which look very small when you look out at a 150 seat house. Very small, there's nothing to do here. We've consistently been able to turn a house of 40 to 50 into a real audience, a real responsive audience, like a good house. And I think it's because the show has gotten better over the run. I think they like the show. Audiences do like the show. The critics like the show pretty much. I think Freddie Prinster trashed it, but I didn't see the review. Everybody else gave it pretty good reviews. There has been a whole flap, a minor flap, about from certain segments of the feminist community who think the show is egregiously sexist and a terrible place. I think the play is, Blood Orgy especially, is egregiously sexist, and that's sort of the point. I think they missed the funny part. I think they missed the joke. The hero's name is Rod Lance. And in the other place, he has 2 brothers, Peter Lance and Dick Lance. He is the most sexist, stupid, and lucky, abusive person in the world, as much as we can make him, who just does nothing but debase women and is a gay character in the show, and tries to kill him. I don't think you can get any more satirical than that. So I don't know. Did anybody have any problem with it? Those of you who've seen it? No. Well, some people have, I think. And I think that's a good sign, because I think people are in danger of losing their sense of humor these days. Jerry Turner wrote a really nice piece in last month's American Theater Magazine about, he ran the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, huge budget. They turned down a $400,000 grant from the NEA because they wouldn't sign the loyalty oath, basically, that came with it for a few months there. Turned down the money. And then next year they did a production of Merchant and got all of this raft of shit from the other end of the political spectrum that the play was anti-Semitic and sexist. And those people wanted them to edit and cut that play. So they were being basically attacked from two ends against the middle. And Jerry had some pretty good things to say about that. I mean, I think if we're going to have freedom, First Amendment freedom, it means some people are going to be offended. But I think there's a difference between being offended and equating it with, well, you know how the argument goes. If you do a tit joke, it's getting to be it's tantamount to rape. It's a very dangerous thing, especially when the intention behind any particular tit jokes in our show, there's lots of them, is to make fun of the person making the joke. I mean, I feel pretty clear in my mind about this. I think we all do. And I'm kind of worried about that political thing that's going on these days. I think it's kind of scary.
I'm just curious, did you anticipate that kind of reaction at all? And then in anticipating it, wouldn't you sort of, I mean, you knew probably that you were going to offend some people, but if you go farther with it, then are you becoming more offensive or are you attacking the issue more? And then, you know, I guess you just have to wait and see what happens. But
we pulled back on a lot of stuff, not because we thought it was too gross, but because it was no longer funny. I mean, that got to be the litmus. We didn't object to saying almost just about anything or doing just about anything, as long as you got a laugh. I think there's a difference there. I mean, you count on your audience to be enlightened enough to see humor if they're not getting it. It doesn't mean that you're fucked up politically, but it does mean that you're not reaching. And since we basically want to reach them, we did crank that a lot. We took a lot of the jokes out of the original script. Really, and it turned out not.
But you were also saying that at the beginning you didn't want to have to try to please people. So I saw it. I enjoyed it. I found it offensive, but for all the right reasons. Do you think that you took anything away from it because you, in the end, had to make some of those considerations?
Yeah, I do. I think it happened a couple of times.
So could it actually gone farther than it went?
Yeah. There's this whole thing in the play about dating. And it's an issue that I think the play, in a comedic way, really dealt with. It really dealt with it. It made the audience think about it. And there used to be this whole speech about one of the CIA agent that goes with Rod Lance down to the Bermuda Triangle to stop Joseph Mengele, which is basically the White Angel of Auschwitz. I mean, you know, at that time, this guy was responsible for the death of 400,000 Jews, you know, and I'm playing it, so if I can have it. But at one point he says, Chalmers, you have to take this Chalmers one. Now, Chalmers, as written, is a flamboyantly stereotypical gay guy. And there was this speech about, hey, I can't take him. And then there was this litany of pejorative terms for a gay person. And it was very Lenny Bruce, you know. Because he used to do all these nigger jokes. You know, he'd say nigger, nigger, nigger so many times until it just became a sound that that was his point, that you can, the words have incredible power, and you can use it or you can take it away from it. You can scribble with its power. So if we're going to call this guy a faggot all the time, there had to be a pretty good point behind it. And the point was, you know, to just say it so many times, I think I'm being obvious, that was the idea. But it got trimmed. And now what Bob says, instead of that litany of, you know, faggot, fruit, queer, you know, blah, 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 he now says, I don't know, he dresses too well. He's got a silk shirt, he wears an Apache tie, he listens. Which I guess says the same thing. You know, he listens. All right. Yeah.
I think this might have put group of the ensemble actors a bit of a risk. Maybe the big artistic directors and producers of Seattle and other regional theaters might think they're a little too wild and they want too much power. Do you think? Jeopardize something?
That's an interesting idea. I don't think so. I don't think so. Because among other things, this group tends to be pretty well respected.
Right.
You know, Bob's a member of the rep company. He's not going to be, I'm sure, he's not jeopardizing his standing with the rep company. Not.
When you talk about process, if you go through a period where you really dealt with issues rather than the form of the idea of the structure of the piece, if you go through a period where you felt, my God, there's AIDS, my God, there's homeless people, how did you deal with that whole issue? Given this amount of freedom and power, it must have been tempting to, like we just did a moment ago, speak very eloquently about the beginning.
Yeah. Yes, okay. We dealt with that. I think our response to all of this is awful. We live in our society, we're citizens, we are concerned. We all live. I think our response to that was bad. And this will sound flip and shallow, but maybe the best thing to do is give people a laugh. But I think it's, you know, kind of deeper than that. I did a show a couple years ago at Apple called The Red Noses. It's a play about the bubonic plague in Europe in 1348. The central character in it is this little monk named Father Flott, who, in the midst of death, killed one out of three people in Europe, and they didn't know what it was. It was this total mystery, but one out of three people dropped dead. This little monk gets a vision from God that what all these dying people need is a laugh. So he forms a, you know, and a laugh. And I think, you know, it's a catharsis is a very cleansing and healing thing. And I think, basically, you want it to be healing to me. But that was a still error in response to homelessness. I'll tell you one thing. We had this great community outreach segment. It's got a slideshow. It showed us going out in the community and reaching out to all these people to be aged and homeless and stuff. And we shot all these slides of yet a needle was changed. Except it was cool days we had a needle. Rubber gloves and condom program, we got condoms to each other. Then we had the whole thing about how we got John Hill. Voiceover. We went out to Occidental Park and we had our very intern dress up as a homeless person. We were shot him coffee, you know, talking to him, and then in the final shot, you know, throwing him into a dumpster. That is terrible. You know, well, sort of, that's the point. You know, Oh, that's a terrible thing. You can't think about throwing somebody in a dumpster. Well, exactly! You can't. You can't even, you know. So what are you going to do instead of throwing him in a dumpster? That was our little shot in that direction. Pictures weren't good enough when they got caught. So I'm okay. Yeah.
What happened to the dynamic of the group when you brought other people into it? You said you started out with no women.
Right. Yeah, because, and it's happening now because, good segue to Dark Rapture, because we've hired two more women for Dark Rapture. We brought in Kit Harris about halfway through the rehearsal period. Well, it just clicked in bang instantly. Because we'd all worked with her. She was sort of de facto a member of the ensemble already. So it was very seamless. Right now it's a little different story because we're doing a real play. It's already being written for us. And we've hired Sally Smythe and a woman named Joanne Schmoll, who I had never seen either before. So it's a little bit more like a typical theater situation. But it's certainly not bad. Excellent actors. Want to hear some Dark Rapture?
Yeah.
When we get out of here. I mean, you guys have to go. I play a guy named Ray. Ray lives in the Berkeley, Oakland Hills with his wife Julia, who's a pretty rich woman to start with. She's trying to be a film producer. I'm not going to tell you too much of the plot because it's a mystery and I don't want to give it away, but it starts the first scene in the Berkeley Hills fire and Ray's house is burning down. And what we find out pretty soon after that is there's $5 million in small arm mark bills in the house because Julia, his wife, is in bed with a lot of guys from the mob and they're laundering their money, drug money, through her film. Well, Ray takes the opportunity to grab $5 million in small armor bills and split. And the rest of the play is his odyssey across the country and her odyssey with the guys who are trying to get the money. Let me read you just he's out there watching his house burn down. He's a Vietnam vet. He's exactly my age. He's a door gunner in Vietnam. Yeah, Huey. And he's watching his house burn down, he's watching the whole hill burn down, and this guy Babcock shows up, and Ray says to him, quiet at night. And Babcock says, fucking A, nothing spookier than a night fire, man, makes you feel so all alone. I remember one time, big island, lava flow, big red hot orange, tons of molten magma, whatever, creeping down the hillside, like some kind of infernal glacier. Eerie fucking thing to be coming at you out of the fucking dark. I'm telling you, fry an egg on that air. That's how hot it was. Soft boil one on the palm of your hand. Melt cars, asphalt like butter, houses just pop, bang, like paper bags, like that. Spontaneous combustion, heat. Nothing to do but grab the cat, count the kids, say a prayer that the lava runs out of geothermal juice, or it desiccates you and yours like so much delicatessen jerky. And then sit back and watch it coming toward you like sheer fucking inevitability lurching out of the dark rapture. I think it's brilliant. I didn't get to say it. That's bad talk. Let me read you one of my speeches here. Ray winds up in Key West having a drink with a woman named Max. Max is in her 40s, she's an ex-drug dealer, Key West HUA. And he's just told her basically the whole story about the fire and everything. He hasn't told her about the money, but he's told her about his wife, who was down in Cabo San Lucas with her boyfriend when the fire happened. And she says, why don't you just call a lawyer and get a divorce? Your wife's fucking around. And he says, but that wouldn't have changed anything. See, we've just been the same old life, only more complicated. Oh, I should tell you, that, like, we've had this text for a week, and we still got 3.5 weeks to I don't have the choices on this material yet. Very few. I mean, I'm not going to act. That wouldn't have changed anything. See, we're just kind of the same old one, only more complicated, extended a little in a perfectly predictable direction. Just another phase and just another ordinary life. Marriage, divorce, dead. You ever want to start over? Change everything, make a clean break? Go somewhere where you don't know anyone, nobody knows you, nobody has any assumptions about who you are. Fire. I saw that fire and I saw myself floating up from the ashes like the phoenix. So liberating to watch my life go up in flames right before my eyes. Everything I own. Papers, photos, family heirlooms. All my personal possessions gone. Like shedding an old skin. I felt that sad. Free, all that baggage, that history, that old life that didn't work, that I fucked up on day one. A great weight lifted off me. I could walk away from all that, reinvent myself. So I bugged out, got on a plane to someplace I'd never been before. Cool my heels and think about how to do this, how to disappear, the incarnate. Eric writes all this old, everything ends in a period. Three words in this period. So I bugged out period. Well, that's a sentence, isn't it? Anyway, I love how the challenge with this particular material, I think, is to get from one idea to the other really fast. Every sentence, every little, like, discrete bite of action. You have to get from one to the other really fast. You have to be very clear in your objective to the speech, and then you get to get from action to action in a word. It's great. I'll do one more little piece here. Later in that same scene, she starts to question the story and thinks he's maybe told her this huge long lie about this fire. So he tells her, yeah, it's a screenplay. She goes, I thought you made it up. He said, yeah, I thought I'd try it out on you. Burn up the flagpole so you can salute. The narrative so far. And then proceeds to tell her lots more lies. But, and I'm not sure how much of the speech is true or not yet. Eric isn't either. She says, some story, got a title? He says, Dark Rapture. As in, you never know. You never know what. You never know what's out there, lurching in a dark rapture. She says, I'm not familiar with that saying. Cambodia. Say that Cambodia. See, appropriate and everything, you know. And the rapture was very dark. Very dark indeed. They used helicopters in Southeast Asia, you may have heard. And some of these pilots, showboats. Like they clip the tops of the trees, fly as low as possible over the rice paddies. Real macho hotshots had bombed down these dirt tracks in the jungle, 6 or so feet off the ground, scraping everything. Like blowing up water buffalo, having a wonderful time. And what the BC did do, a string of wire across the order of rope between the trees. So the next morning, here comes Hotshot. Hellbent in the leather, twing, hits the wire, flips his rotors, goes up in a fireball. Which again, I always thought was the war in a nutshell. All it took to level the playing field, bring down this multi-million-dollar machine is a piece of wire spread across the road. And then she says, you were helicopter pilots at night. Door guy, strafing those bills. I was the guy, after interrogations at 500 feet, used to kick the prisoners out the door. I'm kidding. kidding. I was. Door on a human, but I never kicked anyone from the evening. I lit up an elephant once, dissolved in a big pink cloud. I love that. So, I mean, I think what we've got here is a real poetic, it's a, he calls it an American theater noir. It's a film noir for the theater. I think it's incredibly poetic and, full of really interesting. I hope you guys come and see it.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah, opens up May 6th. Anybody else got any questions? I wish I had been more organized. I don't feel like I don't feel like I've changed anyone's life today. Yeah, but you know, that might change our lives on dark, dismal Thursday night when there's no one else in the theater.